Welcome to the Shortwave Report. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. The Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on the shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcasts at home is quite easy. You just need a shortwave radio with a schedule of English language broadcast, or it's simpler to use a computer or smartphone with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's outfarpress.com, you can listen to the past 5 shortwave reports and find advice for listening to shortwave at home. Please check out the website and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, NHK Japan, France 24, and Radio Havana, Cuba. We'll begin with Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle. A significant number of Israeli politicians and civilians are making preparations for new settlements in Gaza. Middle East analyst and editor Daniel Gerlach talks about the settlement movement in Israel, which has moved from an extremist notion to become popular. He explains that international laws against new settlements remain. The BRICS summit is underway in Russia this year and now includes Iran, Egypt, Ethiopia, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates. Dozens of other countries are considering joining. The goal is to promote peace, security, development, and cooperation in a multipolar world. An interview with Teresa Fallon, director of the Center for Russia-Europe-Asia Studies in Brussels. She assesses the power of the organization as a counterweight to Western influence and how they are working to dethrone the power of the U.S. sanctions as a domineering force in global policy. Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has said now is the time for Israel to end its war in Gaza. Speaking before flying on to Saudi Arabia after talks in Tel Aviv, he said Israel had achieved most of its strategic objectives in dismantling the militant group Hamas. He noted that Israel had made some progress on getting more aid into Gaza, but that more must be done. Secretary Blinken also said Gaza's future governance was being looked at. He said the U.S. rejected calls from some far-right Israeli politicians to reoccupy parts of Gaza.
Just a few miles from the raging war in Gaza, families are setting up their tents and sukkahs for the Jewish festival of Sukkot. But the reason for their gathering isn't purely religious. These are ultra-nationalist Israelis who want to resettle the Gaza Strip. They have come here to discuss and train for the occupation of Palestinian territory. Normally this would be a closed military zone and they wouldn't be allowed here, but the Israeli army and police are securing the event.
Today, we're preparing for the settlement of Gaza, in preparation for turning Gaza into a Jewish city. And today, we are here to organize, to see what it's like on the ground, what it's like to build, what it's like to build new houses.
After the 7th of October, we feel all of us to come and to go to Gaza, because Gaza is our country. 19 years was not, but it's our country.
Israel removed its settlements in Gaza in 2005. Many say that this was a mistake and are pushing to resettle, including members of the current government. Not only ministers and Knesset members from far-right parties, but also Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's Likud party. Although Netanyahu himself has denied there are any plans to resettle Gaza.
Historically, this place belongs to us, and what is the most important thing is that the tragedy, the catastrophe of the October 7 occurred because We didn't control the area. We didn't control these territories, and these territories are essential for our security.
In Gaza, the situation could not be more desperate. Since the war began, at least 90% of its 2.2 million residents have been forcibly displaced. Much of the civilian infrastructure has been bombed to the ground, and more than 42,000 Palestinians have been killed, according to Gaza's health ministry. But not everybody wants to resettle Gaza. This small group of Israelis has come out to protest against the settlers' plans. Some live close by. They're worried that if Gaza is resettled, the war will never end and the hostages will never return.
We believe that their ideology are very risky and dangerous for Israel, for the survival of Israel. And what we are saying is that we want to get separated from the Palestinians, not to get involved in them, in their population. When we've been there, and I've been there as a soldier, it wasn't good. It led only for more death and more hate.
But these concerns fall on deaf ears among settlers. And while they pray for new life across the border, Palestinians in Gaza struggle to survive.
I'm joined now by Daniel Gerlach. He is a Middle East analyst and editor-in-chief of Zenith magazine. Daniel, it's good to see you again. The movement to resettle Gaza, is this just a fringe group of extremists, or do they have significant support in the Israeli government and in Israeli society?
I think they do have significant support in the Israeli government, of course, because two of the champions of the settlers movement and also those who advocate the resettlement of the Gaza Strip or of parts of the Gaza Strip are two of the most important ministers in the cabinet of Mr. Netanyahu. There is Itamar Ben-Gvir and Bezalel Smotrich. Both of them are started as fringe, let's say, politicians, but they have a significant constituency in Israel. And though I don't think that the majority of Israelis think it's a good idea to move back into the Gaza Strip, Israel had evacuated some of the settlements or its settlements in the Gaza Strip when Israel left Gaza, but though not the majority of Israelis support this idea, I think we see how extremists have very successfully pushed through their agendas in various parts of Israeli politics, and settlement is one of them. And let's not forget, especially Bezalel Smotrich, the finance minister and also minister who owns a portfolio of control over the civil administration of the West Bank, has made the argument of security now in order to convince some of his, let's say, colleagues in the cabinet. He said, the resettlement of Gaza is not an ideological question. It's not because we think that it's part of Eretz Yisrael. He said very clearly that it's a matter of security. Mm-hmm. So demographic engineering, demographic changing in the region in order to buttress, strengthen the security of the state of Israel, that's his new argument. And I'm afraid that some in the Israeli government and also in the Israeli public might buy into that. Yeah.
What about the legalities of this, though, Daniel? I mean, according to international law, all settlements, whether in the West Bank or in the Gaza Strip, are considered illegal, right?
Of course, according to international law, and that's also the position of the United States, of European EU members, of Germany. Now, let's not forget that Donald Trump had recognized Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, also occupied Jerusalem, East Jerusalem, and has also transferred the embassy there. He has also recognized Israeli sovereignty over the Golan Heights, if not legally, so at least politically. But yes, the expansion of the settlements in all parts of in all Palestinian territories are illegal according to international law. And what is also interesting is that many in the international arena, in particular in the West, think that this is just like some sort of a sideshow of the Palestine question, of the actual conflict that this is about. And they believe that these issues can be easily solved. But of course, the Israeli government and the ever more stronger settlers movement, which is represented in the Israeli government, is creating facts, is creating fait accompli. That's, by the way, not, and we should be fair about that, that's not only Netanyahu's responsibility. The previous government, which was the anti-Netanyahu coalition of Naftali Bennett, was very much also engaged in expansion of settlements in the West Bank.
Middle East analyst Daniel Gerlach, as always, Daniel, we appreciate your time and your insights. Thank you.
Vladimir Putin has told Chinese leader Xi Jinping that more cooperation between their countries will ensure global security. President Xi said their two countries were upholding international equity and justice. They were meeting as the Russian president hosts this year's BRICS summit. It's the first gathering of the alliance since it expanded beyond the original members, Brazil, Russia, India, and China. And the group is positioning itself as a counterweight to the West.
All right, I want to bring in now Teresa Fallon. She is the founder and director of the Center for Russia, Europe, Asia Studies in Brussels. How would you assess the power of BRICS at this moment? I mean, are we really looking at a counterweight to Western influence?
We're seeing some momentum growing, and it's kind of a group of the disgruntled. Countries that really are upset with the current international order, they see that the West is in decline. And I would say that Russia and China are kind of pushing it the most. Although the first five countries, BRICS, as you noted in your presentation, but this is expanded now. And because Iran is one of the new players in BRICS, everyone is really paying far more attention to it now because of the situation in the Middle East. In addition, I would say that it does pose a possible threat to Western institutions in the fact that they are working together to sanction-proof themselves. This is one of the U.S.'s strengths. So they want to try to get around U.S. ability to sanction these countries. So you have Iran upset with sanctions since 2018, Russia because of the war in Ukraine, and China, this is their biggest fear that should anything happen in tensions between the U.S. and China, that the U.S. and the West could sanction them. So they're looking at a way to get around sanctions. And the more countries in this grouping, the more likely that they will be able to come up with something. Nevertheless, it's a disparate group of countries with very different national interests, and tiptoeing around some of these will be interesting to watch outcome. Modi, the Prime Minister of India, has some issues with China, and so not everyone is in agreement, I would say.
I'm wondering, if you use the term sanction-proof, what does this summit tell us about the U.S.-led efforts to isolate Russia over its war in Ukraine?
Yes, we're seeing that narrative growing, especially since Russia is the host of this event in Kazan. So I think that there have been many meetings before the big shows today and over the next 2 days. So they've had a lot of bilateral meetings. And this is one of the bugbears that they have been wanting to get around, because sanctions have hurt the Russian economy. And they're borrowing some very clever experiments through cryptocurrencies. There's something called Mbridge, and the Bank of International Settlements has been working on this, and China has been a big player in it as well. So this could ultimately dethrone the U.S. And China has long seen the power of the U.S. is not so much militarily, but in their ability to punish countries financially. Mm-hmm. And by hoping to work with BRICS to come up with this sanction-proof regimen would be really important to them. So the other narrative I would say that's very powerful, I looked at the Chinese press on all of this. In one paragraph in People's Daily today, the word Global South was written 14 times. Wow. So they're really emphasizing that they represent the Global South, and that, you know, that they've been neglected and by the Global North, you could say. I don't really like these terms. I think they're too broad, but this is a term of art, and I would say that they're trying to show that they represent the neglected Global South and give them a voice.
Those report interviews were from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, which may be heard at a combined audio-video website, DW.com, as well as on YouTube at their channels called DW News and DW Documentary. They're also available at most podcast sites, as is the Shortwave Report. Next, NHK World Radio Japan. By Thursday morning, BRICS leaders had adopted a joint communique calling for the elimination of unilateral economic sanctions, and 30 other countries have expressed interest in strengthening ties with the bloc. On the sidelines of the summit, China and India vowed to improve relations through dialogue. NHK Japan.
Leaders of emerging economies participating in the BRICS summit have adopted a joint communique. It calls for the elimination of unilateral economic sanctions and other measures they say are contrary to international law. The leaders met in the central Russian city of Kazan on Wednesday. It was the first BRICS summit since the bloc extended its membership from Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa to include Egypt, Iran, and other countries. Russian President Vladimir Putin said more than 30 countries have expressed interest in strengthening their ties with BRICS. He expressed his belief the bloc's influence will grow over emerging markets, including the group of nations known as the Global South.
We are all witnessing the dynamic development of BRICS, strengthening its authority and influence in world affairs.
The leaders discussed strengthening multilateralism at the summit and adopted the Kazan Declaration. The declaration calls for establishing a partner country category to strengthen cooperation with other economies. It also condemns economic sanctions and other forms of unilateral coercive measures they say that go against international law, implying Western sanctions against Russia over its invasion of Ukraine. China and Brazil jointly proposed a peace plan for the Ukraine crisis in May. The declaration said the BRICS nations note with appreciation proposals of mediation aimed at a peaceful resolution of the conflict. China and India have had strained relations since a military clash in a border region in 2020. Now their leaders have vowed to improve those relations through dialogue. Chinese President Xi Jinping and Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi met on the sidelines of the BRICS summit for their first formal talks in 5 years. Xi said China and India should keep sharing the view that they're cooperative partners, not competitors. He also said they should explore ways to develop together. Modi said the relationship is important not just for the two countries, but also for global peace, prosperity, and stability. China and India have had intermittent military clashes along a tentative demarcation line in disputed border areas. They both suffered casualties during fighting in 2020. President Xi and Prime Minister Modi promised that special delegations will hold dialogue and look for ways to resolve differences. Some analysts suggest China hopes to draw India away from building closer relations with countries in the West. They say India likely hopes to nurture its manufacturing sector by attracting Chinese investment and revitalizing economic ties.
Those reports were from NHK World Radio Japan on shortwave. They're heard at 10 p.m. at 11735 or on the web at www.3.nhk.or.jp, as well as most podcast sites. All the times I announce are for Pacific Daylight Saving Time, so please adjust them to your time zone. On to France 24. Some press reviews about COP16, the biodiversity conference that has begun in Colombia, and a press review about how both U.S. presidential candidates promoting fracking may keep people from voting in Pennsylvania. France 24.
Let's start with this front page of French newspaper L'Humanité, biodiversity, action or extinction. Just to give you an idea, in the inside pages there, they're citing figures that say up to 50% of global GDP depends on biodiversity and up to 40% of global jobs. Now, it goes without saying that it's extremely significant that this summit is being hosted in Colombia. This Colombian paper, El Espectador, says COP16 is at home and we must take advantage of it. Now, Colombia is what's called a mega-diverse country. It's home to nearly 10% of global biodiversity. thanks in no small part, of course, to the Amazon rainforest and the Pacific Ocean. Now, The Guardian has this quite interesting piece as we look ahead to the pressure that those countries are now under to save the rainforest. Lula and Petro have the chance of a lifetime to save the Amazon. Can they unite idealism and real politic to pull it off? Now, in this article, they cite figures saying that South America has lost up to 95% of its wildlife since 1970. Gustavo Petro and Lula, the presidents of Colombia and Brazil, are, of course, key custodians of the Amazon. Both of them have been very serious about slowing deforestation, Petro of Colombia more so than Lula, but they have different approaches to climate policy. Petro is extremely ambitious. He's been very hard on fossil fuels. He's signed an agreement and says he's no longer signing off new licenses for oil and gas exploitation, whereas Lula comes from a different political school of thought on that, and he believes fossil fuels will be key to his country's development. However, the two men have this shared commitment to the Amazon, and so it'll be interesting to see during this summit what common ground they find. One area where we expect there will be common ground is something they're talking about here in Courrier International, which is the need for financing. The fact that conservation, protecting land, that has a cost, not just conservation project, not just forest rangers, but also the fact that they have to choose to not develop land and say no to its possible economic benefits in the name of conservation. So this idea that Gustavo Petro's Colombian side is putting forward is fair distribution of the profits from genetic data. Agriculture, pharmaceuticals, research and development, etc., all huge, draw huge profits from using genetic data from biodiverse gold mines like the Amazon. And what they're arguing is that if a country is making sacrifices to protect one of these biodiverse gold mines, those who profit from it should pay something for that, and those conserving those gold mines should make something.
And we've also picked up on a pollution scandal in Pennsylvania.
Yes, well, let's come at this from a US elections point of view, because that's what it is. Pennsylvania, of course, a very important swing state. This is a town that had a terrible fracking scandal 15 years ago in which drinking water went brown, undrinkable and even flammable due to extremely high levels of toxic elements in the water. It remains an issue today. High levels of methane in the water have led to people passing out in the shower. And as you see this headline, I'm not voting for either. Now, fracking has returned to this town after 15 years under a deal made by the Democratic state leadership. And voters are disappointed with both Kamala Harris and Donald Trump, who have come out as extremely pro-fracking. They are particularly disappointed from the Democrat side, who they suspect fear a cliche of a pro-Trump supporter, of a cliche of a rural voter who is by definition pro-fracking, and they say the Democratic Party have given up the votes of people fighting for their lives. It's unclear how popular fracking really is in the state, but certainly with 16,000 jobs tied up in it, they advance with a lot of caution, the candidates.
Those press reviews were from France 24, which may be easily found at their website, france24.com, as well as a YouTube channel called France 24 English. They are also available at most podcast sites. If you have questions or comments about the Shortwave Report or could help support this program like a generous supporter from Athens, Georgia did this week, there's a link for online donations available at my website, outfarpress.com, or you could write to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490. Many, many thanks to everyone who's ever helped keep this freely distributed show going. Please join them. And if you are listening on a public radio station, please, it's important that you support them as well. We will conclude with Radio Havana, Cuba. In Australia, an indigenous senator shouted that King Charles was not his king, and then the prime minister told him that Australia should become an independent republic. In the U.S., protests are growing against U.S. support of the Israeli wars against its neighbors. Radio Havana, Cuba.
An indigenous Australian senator has shouted that Britain's King Charles III during his first visit since taking the throne, saying, "You are not my king," and noting that the British colonizers committed genocide against the First Nations peoples of Australia. Senator Lydia Thorpe shouted to the British monarch, the British king, at a reception for him at Parliament House in Canberra on Monday. She said, "You committed genocide against our people. Give our land back. Give us what you have stolen from us. Our bones, our skulls, our babies, our people. You destroyed our land. You are a genocidalist." She said she called for a treaty between the Australian government and Australia's indigenous peoples, saying that this is not your land, you are not my king. Thorpe continued, she was escorted out of the room at the Parliament building by security forces. Thorpe, a vocal advocate for indigenous Australian rights, is the first indigenous person to represent the state of Victoria in Australia in the Senate. King Charles III was seated on a podium during Thorpe's protest. He spoke quietly with Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese, who also told the monarch it was time for his role to end. The Prime Minister of Australia said, "You have shown great respect for Australians, even during times when we debated the future of our own constitutional arrangements and nature of our relationship with the Crown. However," he said, "nothing stands still." Albanese also expressed his preference for his country to become a republic with an Australian head of state. Solidarity activists at U.S. colleges across the United States are continuing to spread their protests against the Israeli genocide. In Rhode Island, students from across the state are traveling to Providence to join Brown University students in a protest against their school's rejection of their call to divest from Israeli companies complicit in war and occupation. In Chicago, Illinois, Northwestern University sent in campus police to tear down an encampment set up by Jewish students who they dedicated to the people of Gaza. Jewish Voice for Peace, Northwestern, in Chicago said, "We will not allow our traditions to be exploited by those who seek death and destruction. Our ancestors, many of whom endured genocide and ethnic cleansing themselves, taught us never to be bystanders in the face of injustice." In other protest news, last week peace activists again blockaded the entrance to the Creech Air Force Base in Nevada to oppose the role of U.S. drones in Israel's war on Gaza. At least one activist was arrested.
Those reports were from Radio Havana, Cuba. Cuba's website is working well at radiohc.cu, but there's no podcast. On shortwave, Cuba may be heard from noon to 1 p.m. at 15140, and from 6 p.m. to midnight at either 6000, 6060, or 6100. At their website, radiohc.cu, you can stream the English version at noon, Monday through Friday, Pacific time. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people like you to listen to international broadcasts, get a global perspective. You have to look even harder now because of U.S. and EU prohibitions on media. Every Thursday evening, I post a new shortwave report at the website for this show. That's outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows, find information for online donations. There's a link at my website along with the podcast link, and get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report, which is now in its 28th year of production, remains free to rebroadcast upon notification. For 27 years, the Shortwave Report has been produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. I'm still recuperating from a spinal injury, so I'm staying in a house that's connected to the grid. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.